Welcome to the Everything Podcast, the place for everything education. Whether you're a first-year teacher or a seasoned educator, our mission is to help you employ smart strategies in and out of the classroom.
We firmly believe that teacher burnout isn't inevitable. Part inspiration and part implementation, we discuss the why and how to make your classroom effective and sustainable.
We're your hosts, Danielle
and Nicole. Welcome back to another episode of the Everything Podcast. I'm your co-host, Nicole, and today is a really special day because, as you may have noticed, Danielle and I have been focused so much on our newest project called Everything Social, Social Media Solutions for Teacher Side Hustlers, and today's podcast episode is quite different. Today, we are lucky enough to feature Macy Gilson, and we're not talking so much about how we can create social media solutions for teachers today, but instead we're talking about how someone like Macy has been able to use social media to really empower those who need it most. Macy is a speech and language pathologist. She is a disability advocate, and she knows exactly how to leverage platforms like blogging, social media, etc., to make children living with disabilities more visible. Her feed not only shows the behind the scenes of what her life is like as a telecommuting speech pathologist, but also highlights the beauty and joy present in these exceptional children living with a wide range of disabilities. Macy is on a mission to demystify different, providing resources to help both educators and parents alike have what may initially seem like challenging conversations surrounding the topic of disability. Danielle and I could not be more excited to share our conversation with Macy on the Everything Podcast. So let's jump right in. Macy, welcome to the Everything Podcast.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here with you guys.
We are so thrilled to have you. Welcome, welcome. And let's just dive right into it. We'd love to share with our audience what we can about you, what you do day to day, and how we're chatting today.
Sure. Yeah. So I kind of have two little side parts going on right now. By education, I am a speech pathologist, but my biggest passion is as a disability advocate. Mm-hmm. So I was born and raised actually in Southern California, and I moved to Texas when I was 17 to go to TCU on a volleyball scholarship.
Oh, and so I played volleyball. So big fan already.
Really?
I knew we should connect.
And so that's where I met my husband as well. And I played 3 years of indoor volleyball, and then I played a year of beach volleyball. And then I had a career-ending injury, and that kind of gave up volleyball for me and ended everything. And I focused all my attention back on school, and I graduated with my degree in speech pathology. And then in order to be a licensed speech pathologist, you have to go to grad school, of course. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going to Baylor for grad school. And just recently, about a year ago, I really started diving down the path of becoming a disability advocate. Mm-hmm. And I think the combination of the two is like the ultimate career dream. So I just am so excited to be not even really calling my jobs, because they're just my greatest passions.
That is so nicely said.
Thank you. So as a speech pathologist, I'm actually a teletherapist, which is kind of new in our field. I work with kids in really rural places in America, and kids that might not have access to services or to an SLP that's on campus or at least within the district that can get to them. So I provide services over like a HIPAA secure platform, and that's how they get their services. And that's how we do IEPs and conferences and really everything online, which is really cool because kids are already on screens way more than they should be. Mm-hmm. But they're really comfortable with it too at the same time. So we get a lot out of our sessions, and we get to give services to people that otherwise wouldn't have them. So as a speech pathologist, it's pretty rare, but I work from home. And so that's really cool. But in private schools and in public schools. And so I've kind of done several different things when it comes to being an SLP, but this is definitely a really unique experience. And I really like that I can be a disability advocate and a speech pathologist at the same time.
And we definitely want to dig a little deeper into what it means to be a disability advocate. But before we get there, obviously, it's very cool that you get to kind of live your dream job while telecommuting. But you mentioned that you've been a speech pathologist at a variety of schools. for those of us who don't normally get to pick the brain of a speech pathologist, what does a normal day in the life look like when you're at a school?
Sure. So it's pretty different depending on the day. Mm-hmm. Most therapists prefer to make their own schedule when it comes to scheduling their kids, just so that they can group them based on needs or whoever they have to see individually. And obviously working around the classroom schedule too. Mm-hmm. So once the therapist has built out their schedule, then usually IEPs and paperwork and all of that is kind of woven in, just like you guys as teachers do. Mm-hmm. But as far as actual therapy, most people, depending on their IEPs, either have group services mm-hmm. or individual services, and it's usually per week. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my kids I see twice a week, and then for however many minutes depends on obviously their IEP. Mm-hmm. And being at a school is a really unique experience because you get to be with the teachers and you get to see the kids in more environments than just your therapy room, which is really cool. And I think so great, especially when we look at communication, to be able to see kids in their classroom environment or how they're interacting with peers on the playground and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I don't have the luxury of because I'm a teletherapist, and that's something that I do miss. But working in a school is so much fun just because there's that team effort and that collaborative effort, especially the IEP team too, being able to bounce ideas off an OT or a PT or something like that, I think is the coolest part about being an SLP. And obviously as an athlete, that's something that I really miss, is that team aspect.
Definitely. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, telecommuting has so many benefits, I would imagine. I mean, Danielle and I are both introverts, kind of envying the work from home element there. But I understand that definitely kind of takes away from other aspects as well. What would you say is the most challenging aspect of working from home, having had the experience being in a school setting, private, public, so on?
Absolutely. The collaboration, I think, is the hardest part. I was fortunate enough when I first started out, we had to do, all speech therapists have to do a clinical fellowship. Mm-hmm. So that's basically 9 months where you're under supervision, you get to work with a licensed SLP. And I was fortunate enough to work in a non-public school with all non-verbal students that were on the autism spectrum.
Wow.
And so it was such an amazing environment. We actually had several OTs on staff. We had a whole OT gym. And some of the coolest days I remember was going in and doing therapy collaborative with the OT, where the OT could take care of those sensory needs or have them bouncing on a ball while they were working with me on speech, or vice versa. The OT would come into my sessions and give them that they were needing. And it was so cool just to be able to work together. I really miss that aspect. And like I said, because I work in such a rural area, not only is it rare for the kids to get speech services, but it's also rare for them to get OT or to get PT or psych mm-hmm. or whatever else their IEP allows for. And so that's really hard too, to know that a lot of my students need OT, but the OTs in the area, there's such a low amount of OTs in the area that these kids can't get the services that they need.
Wow. Yeah, I can't imagine the extra level of challenge that would present, because obviously, whereas speech pathology could translate to a telecommuting job, OT, probably not so much.
Right. And that's why it's so rare, like especially in the rural areas where I work, because mm-hmm. the OT may only come once a month or every 6 weeks or something like that. And so these kids are getting all their IEP minutes in one session.
Wow.
Which is really hard. So I'm so glad that speech obviously can be done via teletherapy, because it's opened so many doors for so many kids to get services that otherwise wouldn't have access.
And if you spend any time on Macy's website, which you definitely should, because first of all, it's beautiful, but also it's got some great information on there. You clearly do education around all of these areas for not only teachers, but also parents, because they're mm-hmm. key factors.
Absolutely.
In the success here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, from a speech standpoint, of course, and something I always tell parents in IEPs is that, you know, I may spend 40 minutes with your kid a week, but you spend the entire rest of the week with your kid. So even if they're working their butts off for 40 minutes mm-hmm. and they're taking what they learned to their classroom, if that's not being followed through at home, and that's not being followed through when I'm not with them, then it's going to take a lot longer, mm-hmm. obviously, to reach our goals. And so the same thing with disabilities too. I know we're going to talk about that in a second, but teachers can talk to kids about disabilities all day long, but unless parents are following through on that at home and in the community, there's going to be that mismatch.
I mean, parents play a key role, really, no matter what the setting is, no matter what grade level.
it goes without saying that parents and members of the community play a huge role. And I imagine that because you're kind of shouldering maybe even more responsibility, having the role of the speech pathologist, telecommuting, and maybe not even having the support of the other OT or other service members, it can be even more of a responsibility for you, therefore having a larger conversation with parents on a regular basis. Do you find that to be a really tough conversation to have? How do you kind of navigate that?
It is by far the number one question I get asked. And something that I didn't realize was that big of a topic until I became a disability advocate. Mm-hmm. I think I've been so lucky that I have been able to work not only as a speech therapist, but also kind of in my life growing up. I feel like I was exposed to people with different disabilities. And then obviously as an SLP, I work with kids, and I've also worked with adults with a variety of disabilities. And so I'm very comfortable around disabilities, and I didn't realize how many people are uncomfortable around people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where this cycle starts. I think it starts with being uncomfortable, and then that leads to, well, I don't know what to say, and so I don't want to look, and I don't want to introduce myself, and then my kids do what I do. And so it's this generational cycle that I really, really want to break.
And I think that you do it so beautifully, and you articulate yourself so well. And Danielle mentioned your beautiful website, which is, of course, so beautiful and definitely needs to be checked out. And I love the videos that you provide for parents. I mean, the resources that you provide for parents, for educators, are fantastic. And I think that providing that extra little kind of nugget of information for starting a difficult conversation. And I love the way that you use the term demystify different.
Yes. Right?
Just kind of like giving that vocabulary, giving power to that vocabulary, I think is really important. And it does start in the home, which I think we can all agree on. And kind of like, how do you even get to that very first step? So I think your website provides a number of resources, not only for educators, for parents, for people who are interacting with those with disabilities in general.
Right. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's really been just the most amazing thing. And I feel like I had all these thoughts in my head, and it just like took that leap of faith to say, I don't know who needs to hear this, but I hope someone does. And then I'm discovering more and more that more and more people want to hear that and want to know more. And so that's really encouraging too, that people care enough to also want to break this cycle.
Yeah. And if you follow Macy on Instagram, which you should, your feed is just this beautifully curated, but also kind of just celebration of everything that you stand for, as well as the stories of those who are living with disabilities.
Let's talk about the stories. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's kind of where everything started for me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, everybody's on social media now. And I knew that in order for me to get more attention to my website and to my blog and to the resources that I had, that I was going to need to be more prevalent on social media. But as I started thinking about that, I realized if people aren't seeing disabilities and they're not being exposed to them in their regular life, then they're not going to feel the need to use my resources and to go to my website. Mm-hmm. And so I really just wanted people, it kind of started just as a way to educate people when they're scrolling through and they're seeing, you know, fashion or beauty or whatever they're interested in, classroom materials, that then where they're going to scroll and they're going to see someone who they've never seen before. And then they're going to wonder, I wonder who this person is that's on my feed. I want to learn more about them. And so what started out really just as a way to educate people turned into a really awesome way to connect people. And so now when I share these stories, of course, it's encouraging and it's educational for most of my community, but for a small amount of my community, it's amazing to be able to connect them with people who are walking that same path, whether it's something well-known like Down syndrome to really rare diseases and really rare syndromes. I've been able to connect people that would have otherwise maybe never found each other. And getting people plugged into that support system has been the most beautiful thing to watch, especially when it didn't start out with any intention to become that. It was just something amazing that came out of it.
I think the word celebration is so perfect for this. And I I also feel, you know, I was reading one of the stories that you have up recently about Lilith and Edison on your website, which, oh my gosh. And I just love this one quote that the mother had posted. She said, I'm so grateful people who, like Macy, are spreading the news and the worth of our amazing children. A dream for all of us to change the perceptions of non-typical children, to raise awareness and spread inclusion to the world. And I feel like that so perfectly says what it is that you're doing online, whether it's your Instagram feed, the stories that you're sharing on social media, or your website, your blog. I mean, it really is about raising that awareness and demystifying the word different. I mean, I just think you're bringing a lot of kindness to the world.
Thank you. Yeah, I when I first started about a year ago, I came across a statistic by the Down Syndrome Association, and it said that it was something like save Down syndrome. And I thought, like, say, what do you mean save Down syndrome? Like, what's happening to Down syndrome? Mm-hmm. And the statistic was that right now in America, only 10%, 1 in 10 babies that are diagnosed prenatally with Down syndrome are born. So that means that 90% mm-hmm. of babies that are diagnosed with Down syndrome are not being born. And so that's why that Save Down Syndrome movement started. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of really got me thinking, like, gosh, this is something to celebrate. This is amazing. This is life. This is a human being that has the capability to do anything they want in the world. And that really got the ball rolling for me. And that I think is perfectly summed up by Edison's mom and what she shared too.
A beautiful story and so worth reading if you're interested, right on Macy's blog. So speaking of the way that we can actually showcase and celebrate this inclusivity, how would you say is, you know, how's the world kind of changing? How do you feel that schools are changing? How can we start to embrace this language, this movement in our school settings? Our audience comes from a lot of different backgrounds, different grade level subject areas, and for people who are in a traditional school setting and just trying to kind of do right by their students and for members of their community, even if those students aren't necessarily interacting with those who are different from them on a day-to-day basis. What do you think is a great way to get moving with this?
One of my favorite quotes is by Martin Luther King Jr., and he says that the goal of true education is not only intelligence, but intelligence plus character. And mm-hmm. I think so often that second part kind of falls into the background, and parents rely on teachers to teach that, and teachers rely on the home to teach that, and the ball just kind of falls somewhere in between. And I think it's everybody's responsibility. I think as a society, it's our job to be a village for every kid in our community. And to leave a generation that's better than ours. And so I think it's not only everybody's responsibility, but specifically in the school setting. Obviously, it's different if you're in a secular environment, if you're not. But I think the first step toward promoting any type of disability awareness in the classroom is, number one, to talk about disabilities. Mm-hmm. And this can be done in a variety of ways. I think sometimes when people say, talk about disabilities, I'm not wishing or wanting a teacher to give a lecture on cerebral palsy. But what I do want to happen is for inclusive literature to be used in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I want teachers to read books that have characters with disabilities, or show a YouTube clip that relates to what they're learning that features somebody with a disability. Mm-hmm. And those kind of more natural ways to bring it in foster the conversations that I'm hoping that teachers can have.
I think a great place to start with that is one of your recent blog posts, My Favorite Books About Disabilities. I was checking that out. I think that might be just a nice kind of way to ease into this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think literature is a great first step. I cannot agree more with that. I use a lot of video and audio in my classroom. I think that's another way. I like that, just kind of embedding it into what you're already doing rather than having a standalone lesson. I think that we can all agree that that's just not, you know, that's not going to feel authentic.
Of course.
One of the picture books that you actually shouted out, one of the reasons that you said you liked the book was because the character happened to be deaf.
Yes. Yes. So that I love book, that. Boy, that I think is the coolest part of that story. It's not a story about a boy who is deaf and how his deafness is such, you know, a burden on his life or something he has to overcome. It's just a boy who's on an adventure and he's going to defeat the king, and he happens to be deaf.
Right.
And that, I think, is the coolest part of it. And it's such a great way to explain it to kids, especially younger kids. This isn't something that's sad or scary or weird. It's just a part of who somebody is, just like your curly hair is a part of who you are. And that's another thing that I really suggest too, is to really, like I said earlier, demystify what the word different means. Different mm-hmm. isn't something that we need to be afraid of. And especially in our culture, we are so afraid of different. And that can start with something as simple as who has two siblings, who doesn't have siblings. Like, those are differences. And those are things we're totally comfortable talking about, just like hair color, eye color, all those things that so many of us do at the beginning of the year and get to know me and get to know you. It's so easy to also incorporate in what bigger differences are or other differences. And then after talking about differences, it's great to talk about similarities too. Mm-hmm. And talk about, well, here's a girl in a wheelchair and you're a girl that's walking and you might not think you have anything in common, but you both love XYZ, or you both are in third grade, or you both have a little brother. And kind of making those ties for kids, because kids don't do that naturally. They see someone that's different and they think there's not one thing that's similar about us, when really there's one thing that's different and everything else is probably pretty dang similar.
That is something that a lot of teachers would probably feel more comfortable
mm-hmm.
doing. I think a lot of people might be maybe intimidated by and want to shy away from those conversations. Like, I don't know where to start with this. Who am I to talk yeah. about disability in the classroom? Things like that. Whereas right. the teacher being the person to foster connections, I feel like, is a very comfortable space for a right. lot of people.
And honestly, that's kind of how I started too. I mean, now I would call myself a disability advocate, but in the beginning, what kind of started as just, I am a speech pathologist and I know a lot about speech and I'm passionate about it, but I also work with people who have disabilities and I want to be able to share about these people and celebrate these people and tell their stories, kind of turned in to me becoming a disability advocate. And at first I just deferred to, you know, when I would get a question, I would defer to the Down Syndrome Association, or I would mm-hmm. defer to the Special Olympics. So I would always kind of defer people elsewhere. And then as I started doing that, I started learning, like, well, I actually do know a lot about this and I've learned a lot and I keep learning a lot about this. And so I think that's dead on with what you're saying for teachers too. I think it would be great to start those conversations, or to challenge parents to have those conversations at home, and just kind of be the spark plug that gets it going. And I think that's a really natural way to kind of lead into these conversations.
And if you are maybe outside of the kind of humanities, maybe you're thinking to yourself, this sounds really great for people like Danielle and Nicole. They teach English and Spanish respectively. So, like, right. there's a really natural extension of this. Uh-huh. What about teachers who teach science or math or something? Do you have any tips for them to include this type of language in their classroom?
Yeah, I think really just normalizing it in your classroom. So when you have a worksheet or you're going to learn about somebody, instead of drawing kids on the board or characters mm-hmm. on the board that are able-bodied, yeah. throw in somebody with a cleft lip, or throw in somebody with a limb difference where their arm stops at their elbow, because naturally someone's going to raise their hand and say, mm-hmm. well, why does that girl only have one arm? Or, oh, what did you draw on her mouth? Mm-hmm. And now you're just answering questions. You're not sitting everybody down and having this conversation, but you're addressing it in the classroom and you're sparking that curiosity to lead to those further conversations.
That's so great and so easy to mm-hmm. incorporate into what you are already going to be doing.
Right.
And
I think too, something that's another way to kind of put it off onto somebody else, if you're maybe not feeling that comfortable,
mm-hmm.
I always recommend to just talk to the parents at the beginning of the year,
mm-hmm.
Invite families to come into your classroom, maybe somebody once a month to come in and maybe just send a letter home. Hey, we want our classroom to be welcoming. We want our classroom environment to be inclusive, and we want our students to be, you know, aware of people with unique abilities in our community. So if you know somebody, or if somebody in your family, or you have personal experience with somebody with a unique ability, we want you to come to our class. We want you to teach our kids, because chances are somebody in your class knows somebody or lives with somebody
mm-hmm.
that they can share about. And then that pressure is kind of off you. And your kids can be exposed to something by an expert. And especially too, if it's a sibling, if it's somebody that your kids are going to see in their community, that's mm-hmm. even better than maybe like a distant relative or something like that.
Right. And it keeps the conversation flowing outside of the classroom as well. Having the right. home engaged, I think that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So Macy, I do want to switch gears a little bit. And we touched on it earlier in the recording when it comes to the way that you show up on social media.
Yes.
And we have a lot of teachers who, of course, also have a side project, a side hustle. Uh-huh. whatever they're doing to sell the thing that they're creating for their classroom, for their fellow educators and students. And with that goes all of the ways that they show up online. And we just, you know, we want to continue to compliment you and just celebrate how you're doing and showcasing inclusivity in and out of the classroom space. And I guess what I'm getting at here is, when you do, in fact, share these stories online, when you choose to show certain images or share a certain anecdote, I mean, what is kind of the process that you go through, and why do you make the decisions that you do to share the stories that you do? It's so powerful. It's so moving. And we just kind of want to give, you know, shine light on that, because I think it's very intentional and it really is so powerful.
Thank you. So two things. The first thing, I never have ever not said yes to somebody who's asked to be featured. So that process isn't that hard for me. Just, I have a list going, and whoever's next on the list ends up on the feed. Because like I said, I refuse to say no to anybody. I think every kid is worth celebrating. However, when it comes to my feed itself, or what I choose to post when I post, not including the kids that I post, I was told by someone very wise one time that you have approximately 7 seconds to make an impression on somebody when they come to your Facebook, your Pinterest, your Instagram, whatever it is. So if I know I only have 7 seconds for somebody to decide if they want to be a part of my community or not, or follow along or not, I want to make sure that in those 7 seconds, see exactly what I'm about. And so I make sure that always in kind of that top six photos or top nine photos that you see when you go to someone's Instagram page, without taking time for them to scroll or to click through my highlights or anything like that, no matter what, they're going to see a picture of one, if not two, if not three kids. They're going to see a picture of my home life, my husband, my dog. They're going to see something inspirational, whether that be a quote or, you know, a sign that I saw or something like that. And then they're going to see kind of what I'm all about. Do I like to read? Do I like to sing? Like, what do I like to do? Because I really want to make sure that those 7 seconds, they're getting a grasp of all the things that I do and all the things that are important to me, because those are the things that they're going to see if they follow along.
Now, I have a question about, how do you make it all look so together when you are pulling from so many other people's stories? You're sharing their stories in a way that it, you still recognize it as your feed.
Thank you. I spend a lot of time deciding kind of what to add. I really just base it around the kids that I'm going to share. And then I kind of pick and choose what pictures I have that go around that. And like I said, I always make sure that in those top, you know, nine squares, there's a little bit of all of me. But as far as that, it's kind of funny. Like, I feel like the photos that I get, like, these kids are so beautiful and they're so amazing that, like, it's not that hard to make it fit into, like, my light and airy and white feed, because they're just like, I don't know, these kids are so joyful that rarely do I get a picture of a kid crying in a hospital bed. That might be a story that they share in their post, but when that parent submits a photo, they're submitting all the joy that their child captures. And there's, you know, they're sharing with me that which comes out in the photos of their kids. But other than that, as far as the photos of me or of the things that I like, I am by no means a photographer. It's just me and my iPhone and occasionally my very selfless husband. And we set up a little, usually maybe a couple times a month, we'll just kind of get all the things that are going on, whether that be books I'm reading or websites that I'm going to or signs that I saw. And we'll kind of get it all together in one room and just knock out the photos. And then I kind of have them to do with what I please. But really, all of my social media focuses mostly on the kids. And then I just kind of pick and choose what might represent me to go around them.
I love it. And it sounds like you are employing your husband to help you kind of like batch the photos behind the scenes.
I realize that is, I mean, everyone's biggest tip when you try and start off on social media, everyone's like, be consistent. Yep. And you think like, okay, I work a full-time job and I'm trying to do this side hustle. Like, I can't take a pretty picture every day.
Right.
So I'm sure I'm one of those people where they're like, how do you do that every day? I can't take that every day. But Instagram is not what it seems. Like, for instance, some real life, the photo I posted yesterday was taken earlier in January. And really all of my photos were either taken you know, within the same day or the same couple days. And I get ready one time. I have a couple different outfits laid out. I take as many as I can in as quick of a time as I can. And then I have them to do with as they fit. Mm-hmm. But it also is really easy for me because I have all these kids to share.
Right.
So I don't have to come up with as many photos as somebody that might be showing their resources, mm-hmm. or somebody that might, you know, be selling stuff from their TPT store. So if you're that person, I would suggest getting all of your stuff together and maybe picking a Saturday morning and giving yourself 2 hours and seeing how much can I get done in these 2 hours and have content for 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And not have to constantly, I mean, that's the worst part of social media, that like, oh, I got to post something. What am I going to post? Is anybody going to like it? Is it going to match my feed? Like, that's right. The worst part of mm-hmm. it.
One thing that kind of comes to mind when I think of you and I think of your message is I feel like you're a real storyteller. Like, I feel like when mm-hmm. I look at your feed, I mean, it's personal. It's also celebrating other children, other families. And I feel like you just create this platform of kindness and positivity. And I feel that having, and we use the word stories, and I'm not just talking about Instagram stories, but also the stories that you share on your website of families' journeys down the, you know, different paths that kind of their lives have taken them. And specifically when it comes to disabilities and different diagnoses, how do you engage those communities? I think that that's a really big part of making a great presence online is engaging others. And I find that it's very isolating if you don't do that, yes. right? And it's also a huge way to just build who you are and your following and the impact that you're making. Can you speak on that a little bit and how you do get all of those requests to share the children? Like how does that kind of work?
Yeah.
And how are you engaging all of those different members of your community that you've created?
So I'm not, you know, some Instagram guru, but from what I understand based on the algorithm, kind of how it works is that your discover page is based off of like photos that you like and you interact with and that interact with you. So for me, I obviously interact with a lot of families who feature their child that has disabilities or special ed mm-hmm. teachers, stuff like that. And so when I go to my discover page, granted, when I was getting married, it was like wedding dresses. Now, when I go to my discover page, it's all these amazing kids. And so I'll go through there and I'll like as many as I can and comment on all these beautiful lives. And then from there, one of the first things people see when they come to my website is the share your story button. And so a lot of people would just do it that way. Every once in a while, people will message me like, hey, I see that you share stories. I would like to share mine. Mm-hmm. But I think it goes both ways too. Sometimes I'll see somebody and you know, their parents already doing a great job of sharing their story online. And I'll say like, hey, this is what I do. I connect people with other people that might be going through the same thing. I think your story is something that our community could really benefit from. And I think a lot of parents could benefit from hearing what you've been through. Can I share your story? And I have occasionally had people say no, mm-hmm. But a lot of people are so willing to connect with people that are walking the same path that they are, that they're more than willing to share. And so that's a highlight for me too, not only getting to learn about these kids, but really the joy comes from getting to connect them with somebody that also has this really rare disease that, you know, 5% of kids have.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really cool as well.
Uh-huh. You're able to still find that like way of kind of like building a team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
this,
I know.
This virtual
it
team.
Looks like that.
That's so true. It does.
And I think too, like once I've shared a story and granted, I obviously share it on my website and the parent goes usually into a lot of depth of whether that be from diagnosis till now, or maybe if it was an at birth diagnosis from kind of what their birth story looked like until where they are now. But I also get the chance to follow that person. And so I see their daily life. So for me, mm-hmm. that's a really cool thing too, to know like, okay, I shared this story a year ago when their child was nonverbal and not sharing any words with them or didn't really have a way to communicate. And now a year later, I'm watching them post Instagram stories of their child requesting milk or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it might be. And so just as much as they're a part of my feed, I get to be a part of their feed and their lives and see them on a daily basis. So for me, something huge is being able to tag them and to share them and to make sure that people can follow them because that daily life is what people want to see too.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the disability community, it's not all rainbows and happy faces.
Right.
There's a lot of hardship and there's a lot of struggle. And so for somebody that's sitting at home thinking like, oh my gosh, I have this diagnosis and I don't know what to do. And I am in, you know, the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
They maybe don't want to see all of this positivity. Life's going to be great. They might want to see that real life. I want to go to your Instagram story. I want to meet you. I want to know if you were ever in my shoes and like, is this going to get better?
Yeah. And I imagine that in that way, it's really, you know, you're featuring the children when you're posting the pictures.
Yes.
But a lot of this is really for the adults in
it
the room.
It is 100%
because
for the adults.
I know one of the things that I have always really liked that Animal Planet does really well is whenever I watched an episode of like My Cat from Hell, they would have the section that is called My Cat from Heaven. And sometimes they would feature cats that had disabilities and they're like, it's a normal cat. The cat doesn't know that it's blind or whatever. No one's telling the cat this.
Uh-huh.
So as a result, the cat just plays like a cat and does everything else. And it's kind of other people who are imposing these limitations that they think the cat has.
Yeah.
And I imagine, especially for some of those children, especially if they're really, really young, they have no idea that they have a disability. They have no idea what that word means. That they don't know. And it's really the parent that's kind of going through the process of how do we deal with this? What do we do?
Right.
And you're providing that support system.
Yeah. That was something I noticed early on too. Just the different stereotypes that were around disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so I started a little blog series that focuses on the misconceptions versus the realities of Down syndrome or of autism that really explores like, this is what society thinks about something specific about Down syndrome, but this is what actually is true about Down syndrome. And I think breaking down those myths is really one of the biggest ways to get people to kind of shift that narrative of what they, those kind of predisposed things that they might have from their childhood or from growing up, or especially people that are our generation to older, because they lived in a time where if somebody was any bit different, they were institutionalized. So,
yeah,
I mean, we're lucky enough to live in a society where we are at least in the same community as somebody that might have a difference. Whereas people that are older than us didn't even have that exposure. And
yeah,
so their misconceptions are really strong.
And it sounds like this is the kind of thing that, again, if you're thinking about how can I bring this message to my classroom without necessarily spending an entire lesson on talking about this, this sounds like, I know at my school, we have a Disabilities Awareness Club.
Uh-huh.
This would make for a great bulletin board for the Disabilities Awareness Club to do, or for one of the teachers, if you have a smaller bulletin board, just to bring some information about myths and misconceptions about these things people think they know.
Right. And I think, too, especially, I mean, we already are so lucky to have things like Autism Awareness Month or, you know, all those things coming up. It's so great to just kind of piggyback on those things that are already happening, or later in March, on March 21st. Is Down Syndrome Awareness Day, which is very cool because it's the third month and the 21st day, which is representative of the third copy on the 21st chromosome. And so I think using things like that, and I always use things like that, and I will on Down Syndrome Awareness Day or Down Syndrome Awareness Month or whatever it is. I know I'm using Down Syndrome a lot, but whatever it might be, I'm using that to bring awareness too.
I saw one of your recent posts on your website was about the Disney Plus short animation Float. And like my students are high schoolers and they can't stop talking about Disney Plus. So I feel like there's always a way in.
Yes. And it's so true because if kids aren't taught, you know, what I'm trying to preach at a young age, they're just going to grow up and the cycle is going to continue. So it's not like you just magically wake up and you're a high schooler and you just are aware of disabilities and you're inclusive. And so I think it's just as important for older kids, especially high schoolers, to understand those things, especially as they become adults and start to form their own opinions. And as scary as it is to say, in the next few years, become adults and get married and parents.
Yeah.
It's really important that they don't have these misconceptions and that they are inclusive and open-minded about people with disabilities.
So well said. And your resource, all of your resources are a really great place for us teachers, us parents, you know, any leaders in a school setting to start and to really kind of grasp sort of the building blocks that maybe we want to implement in our classrooms, conversations we're having at home. And we're just so grateful for all that you're doing for this community.
Thank you. I'm so thankful for you guys for being just as invested in this as I am.
Well, seriously, Macy, this has been so wonderful. I mean, from storyteller, blogger, SLP, disability advocate. You're doing so much for a community that we all really need to be more inclusive of and raise awareness about. And we're just so grateful to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I feel so honored.
If you'd like to learn more about us and the services that we offer, head to everything.com.